Okay, guess we're going to get started. Since we don't have anybody in the audience, everybody knows each other, we're going to skip the introductions. We're also going to skip the first action item until we get a quorum, so we won't approve the agenda or the minutes until we get one more person. But we will start with the informational items, and hopefully we get one more board or committee member here. So actually, Kevin's going to do the board update this time, since I wasn't able to get my flight to Salt Lake, so he'll give us an update.
Okay. The board pretty well supported everything that came out of this council, except for two things. On the dedicated hunter hour, you know, with how they're going to do hours for the dedicated hunters, our council voted to allow for a banking provision to start in January and go through when they're notified of their permits. The board opted to go with the division's recommendation instead of allow for banking, because it will accomplish the same thing, but there may be a 1 year delay in that. But I did get a promise from our dedicated hunter folks in Salt Lake that they will, you know, any of those spring projects here in the southern region, that they will advertise the heck out of them, and they guaranteed me personally that they would make sure that the sportsmen's organizations in the southern region that have activities going on during that time period where people are kind of in limbo on dedicated hunters, that they would make sure that we get the help that we need. So so let's hold them to it, I guess, is what I would, you know. Dave, with your fishing derby and that kind of stuff, let's hold them to their word on that. So the other thing that took probably the majority of the time at the board meeting, also the majority of the time at our RAC meeting, was the Monroe Mountain recommendation, what we do with the spike hunt on the Monroe Mountain. Similar to down here, that took a lot of time at the board meeting. The board in the end did opt to go with the division's recommendation, and so there will be no rifle spike hunt on the Monroe for the next 2 years. Now, it will just be for the next 2 years, or possibly things could change in 2 years, because that's when the elk management plan, the statewide elk plan, will be revised, and I know they'll take a hard look at the spike hunt, especially relative to age objectives and what that means on the backside. So that, other than that, you know, it was pretty straightforward, but I'd be glad to answer any questions if I can on those two items.
I have a question on another item. Did they discuss mountain goat hunting later into the season at all?
They did, and I think they did an action log item on that. Brian, the archery, I can't remember his name right now. Ben Louder brought that up, and I think they took it serious, and they I believe Teresa or Steve, do you remember? Wasn't there an action log item on having the once in a lifetime hunts go later? So I think that'll be looked at serious, and you know, I think it's got some validity. So, any other questions? Okay, you want me to just roll into the regional update, Dave?
Yes, please.
As far as a I'll run through each of our sections and just give you a flavor of what's going on with our wildlife section. Obviously, right now they're right in the middle of deer classifications, and there's our quorum just walked in. Thanks, Sean. they're right in the middle of deer classifications, and as you know, those have always been very important, but they're especially important now because of, you know, with having each unit managed as a unit, you know, the buck to doe ratios become even more important. And so we we put a lot of time and effort into making sure we get that right. And I will throw it out that, that if anybody is interested in riding along with one of our biologists or conservation officers while they're doing deer classification, I would be more than happy to facilitate that. When I say I would, I mean Teresa would be very happy to facilitate that. We've got a lot of transplants and capture projects coming up. It's going to be a really busy in January, but also, you know, exciting. We've got bighorn sheep that we'll be bringing from the Newfoundland Mountains and Antelope Island down to the Oak Creeks. Last I heard, that may be as many as 70 sheep that are coming, which will give that, you know, the population on the Oak Creeks a jump start. But really, as we mentioned before, that project's more about protecting the Antelope Island and the Newfoundlands from getting too high of densities and having disease problems. Is really the emphasis there, even more so than creating a new population. But obviously, we're excited to see what we can do with sheep on the Oak Creeks. We'll also be capturing sheep on the Zion unit and moving most of those over to the southeastern region, Teresa, to the Pine Valley unit. No, not the Pine Valley, the Abajo unit, is that correct?
Part of them to the southeastern
region. Okay, and... Okay, so if you didn't hear that, so some to the southeastern region, some to the... Just moving them within the Zion unit, and some potentially to the north end of the Pine Valley unit. We'll also have capture projects going on the Parowan front to continue the translocation study. We'll be collaring deer on the Pine Valley, on the Monroe, and just collaring them for the survival data that we get from that. And then we will also be conducting another deer translocation with deer from Antelope Island to the Oak Creeks. And so it's going to be really busy for our wildlife section over the next several months. Lastly, within the wildlife section, a few months ago, this council took a vote and requesting an update on the cougar research, if you remember. John has been working on that, and probably in February, we will hold some open houses around the state specifically to try to get that information out. We're thinking we'll probably go with open houses rather than doing it during a RAC meeting, simply because there's 17 years of research, and to try to summarize that in 15 minutes, which is kind of what you would get in a RAC meeting, probably wouldn't do it justice. And so we're thinking, you know, a little more lenient time frame, and we'll certainly get that advertised and let everybody know when and where it's going to be, so that we can. And it probably a 45-minute presentation from the researchers, and plenty of time for questions and answers and that sort of thing. Anything you want to add to that, John? Okay. From our aquatic section, the one thing that Richard wanted me to mention, and he was out sampling this morning, is that the ice is on all of the reservoirs except for Fish Lake. He was out on Panguitch Lake this morning, and he said three of them caught 30 fish in a couple of hours through the ice at Panguitch Lake, and that's, you know, pretty typical. Typically, fishing is really good when the ice first comes on, so now's the time to get out and do that if you'd like. Our habitat section is still working hard on all the projects that they're doing. Fall and early winter are really busy for them. Our law enforcement section, most of you are probably aware, you know, we've got a very big effort going to try to find out and prosecute whoever it was that killed the great big poached the great big buck there south of Cedar City. Last I heard, the Facebook page that's associated with that has had over 100,000 hits in the last 10 days. You know, I just hope that I'm sure somebody out there knows something. And there's a fairly large reward, at least $8,000 that I know of. I've heard that there may be some additional outside funding for rewards. We may be pushing $15,000 to $20,000 in reward money for information on that. So, you know, I just hope, as I'm sure the rest of you do, that we find out who did that and we take care of it. There's another, you know, fairly significant poaching incident that took place on the Fish Lake with a trophy bull. We've also put out a lot of media on that to try to get some tips and hopefully take care of that one as well. I will say on that buck there south of Cedar, we have had a fair number of tips come in that our guys are following up on. I don't have any idea if any of them have much credibility to them or not, but certainly they're following up on any leads that they get. So, and then in addition to that, you know, and it's along the same vein, our law enforcement guys are doing their winter range patrols. Have you started winter range patrols already? Or are they coming? So, and that's specifically to try to stay on top of anybody that may be taking advantage of deer this time of year when they're vulnerable. From our administrative services, we've got the St. George Bird Festival coming up in the end of January, and maybe I'll just give Lynn a minute to talk about that, if you would. Just dates and times and what people might expect.
Actually, I've got three events that we can cover really quick, if that's okay.
Yeah, please do.
That being one of them, and that's the outreach section, not the administrative services.
No,
but that's
sorry.
Okay. Where are you?
You're right.
January 23rd, 24th, and 25th, the St. George Winter Bird Festival. We have several hundred people come down to St. George from the Wasatch Front and areas around the state and Nevada as well to come down and go on field trips and attend workshops and whatnot on bird watching in the St. George area. It's a great place for winter birds. It's south for a lot of species, so they're down there to enjoy what used to be really nice weather until lately. Anyway, that's the 23rd, 24th, and 25th of January. Then February 8th is Bald Eagle Day. The location on that is either going to be Cedar Valley, but it's probably going to be Canaraville. I'm going to try to hold it in Canaraville this year so that we can attract people from St. George and Cedar City as well to come to a more central location. Also, we have an ice fishing clinic going on at Fish Lake on the 8th, the same day as Bald Eagle Day.
Oh, thank you. I'd forgotten about that one.
And that'll be taking place up there, and Richard Hepworth will probably be involved with that. Well, he will be involved with that as well.
And that's a joint thing between the division and SFW is helping to host that as well. We're hoping to be a good event.
Great, great. And then the 21st and 22nd of February is the Snow Goose Festival in Delta. Last year we had the first time we've had any kind of a challenge getting birds at all. We're hoping to have the contingent of 20 to 25,000 of them there in town again this year like we normally have. So those things are coming out. It's 21st and 22nd of February.
Thank you, Lynn. And then lastly, with admin services, the one thing that's going on is the turkey application period is open. Anything else, Steph, everybody's waiting for, and that obviously that application period will open towards the end of January, and things will get really busy. So, you know, one item of note that Greg covered at the board meeting in his division update, you know, Utah continues to kind of buck the trend against all the other western states in terms of the strength of our permits and people applying for the draw, and just as another demonstration of that, the sportsman's permits that just happened, applications were up 20% again for that this year. So, you know, I think that's a credit to this process and the product that it puts on the ground, as well as a credit to the people that work for the division and work hard to make sure that we do put a good product on the ground. So, you know, and that's not the case in the other western states. They're struggling mightily to get interest in their product and in the hunting that's happening, and we're just not seeing it. So that's good for us. And I think that's it. Unless anybody has any questions.
Yeah, Kevin, what's happening on the Navajo Lake Dike? Is that going to go forward this year, or is it
a problem? We're looking at 2015 for that. We've been looking at, that's kind of been the date from the beginning. We'll continue to work closely with not only Kane County, but also there's a large interest with Iron County because that's where most of the people that use Navajo come from. We're in the process of raising money. It's about a $3 million project to replace that dike. We're also talking about putting a new boat ramp in, and we're working with federal aid and everything on that. But our target date would be the summer of 2015 to do that project. Any other questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. Let's move back up to item number two. We need to approve the agenda in the minutes. Do we have a motion to do so? Rusty?
I'll make a motion to approve the minutes and the agenda.
Okay, we have a motion to do that. Do we have a second? Can we have a second from Mike? All those in favor? Okay, that's unanimous. Okay, now we move down to item number five, which is an action item, license agent procedure rule amendment, and Phil Gay will present that to us.
Good evening. Thank you. My name is Phil Gray. I'm a business analyst with the licensing section out of the Salt Lake office. Tonight I'm going to be presenting a couple of rule changes to R-657-27, our license agent procedure. This is the rule that deals with how the division works with independent business owners, big retail stores, Walmart, Sportsman's, Cabela's, all the way down to Beaver Sport and Pawn. All the people that sell licenses for us clear across the state. First thing, just a few minor housekeeping edits. Try and make some wording throughout the document consistent. Get rid of some archaic terminology we no longer use. So, well, we want to provide the division with the authority to require license agents to use what's called an ACH, or an automated clearinghouse. This is basically an electronic automatic payment method of monies owed the division. So when a license agent sells a wildlife document for us, they get a cut of it, and then the division gets the rest. Normally, this can be handled several ways. That money transferred back to the division. They can send in a check every month. They can pay by credit card, or they can do the ACH. Right now, we have just over 300 license agents across the state. About 70 of them use 170 of them use the ACH. The rest send in checks. There's a handful that pay by credit card every month, maybe two or three. So it's about half and half of agents that use checks, half that use the ACH. But the large majority of the money that comes back to the division from these license sales is through the ACH, just because big companies like Walmart, Sportsman's, Cabela's, those big places use it. So the large dollar amounts go through that way. It's very safe. It's very secure. It's a good way for us to ensure that we get the money that's owed the state. We do have some agents that become delinquent. They'll send in a check whenever they feel like or whenever they can. And we are losing some money on that. We need to make sure that when there is a situation where we have a problem agent, that we're not being able to get the money from them, that we can require them to go on this and automatically get our money every month. The wording that we've put into the rule, though, is that we may require it, not that we will require it. So those ones that we do need to work with, that we need to have some latitude with, we can. We're also going to require license agents, anybody that sells licenses from their store, wherever they're at, to require or to allow their employees, the ones that are selling the licenses to the public, to have access to the Utah.gov internet domain. All of our websites are hosted on this domain. With the changes that we're experiencing in our modern technology, a lot of the information, hunt boundary maps, season dates, application guidebooks are only available online. For a long time, you'd go into a Walmart, you'd want to buy a deer tag, you want to make sure you got the right unit, but there is no way to look at the unit boundaries there in the store because their corporation was blocking that within the store. So the employees that were supposed to be selling these documents, supposed to be our agents and acting in our stead, were not able to get to the information that they needed. We've worked it out with Walmart. There's a few other stores that are still on the bubble about it. They are worried that their employees are just going to screw around on the internet all day. I can relate, but that's not our problem. We need to have them have the ability to get to all the information they need to sell their licenses. We want to remove the language that allows the division to provide some computer equipment, except for the first printer. When this law was written, it was 10, 12 years ago. Computers were very expensive. The setup for everything was very expensive, a lot of initial investment. The way the license sales system is now, the only way you can sell it is online. So you already have to have a computer. You already have an internet connection. All our existing agents already have the equipment, the tools, technology to do what they're already doing. All we're doing is removing a bit of the rule that we haven't used in ages. A computer is now the cost of doing business. The technology has come down in price drastically in the last dozen years, so we don't think it's something that we should be providing. We want to reduce the amount of time license agents are required to keep the audit copies of the licenses that are sold. So when you go into a license agent, in the past, this is what you would get. This is what prints off. Y'all recognize combination license. The bottom portion has all of your name, address, height, weight, birthday, sex. Everything that somebody needs to seal your identity is right there. We are requiring license agents to keep this for a year in their store. And it was just a matter of time before a box of these ends up in a dumpster somewhere and we get sputtered on the news and ridiculed for it. So what we've done is we've stripped it down. The bottom portion that the agents now keep has the license code, license number, and the date that it was sold on it. And all we're going to require them to do is, once they reconcile their records, if they're happy with what they sold today matches what's in their drawer, they can destroy them as they please. If they want to keep them a year, they can. But there's no way that anybody can get your information off of that without going through our system, and I can tell exactly who, when, and where looked up your information at any time. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any questions from the right? Any questions from the public? Bryce? You're the only public one here. Okay. Okay, Rusty?
So have you contacted a lot of agencies, and they're pretty savvy with the stuff, especially
yeah.
the small...
Yep.
Small mall pop-ups.
Haven't had any pushback on it at all. Mm-hmm. Like I said, the really only big pushback on this initially when I took this position was Walmart didn't want their employees getting anywhere on the internet other than the license sales site and Walmart.com. And I've worked that out with them. They can get to any page on wildlife now.
Okay, I don't have any comment cards. Do we have any comments from the rack? If not, we're...
Let me make one comment that's related to this. Phil mentioned that there's a portion of the, the sale that goes to the license agent, and our admin services group has been successful with some of the larger retail outlets that do this in getting them to donate that portion back to the division, and we use it for a variety of things, and I think they're working pretty diligently with some of the others.
Yeah.
So,
for example, on that, three out of every four licenses in the state of Utah goes through a Walmart, and Walmart doesn't keep any of their remuneration. It all comes back to the division.
And
so that 10% that they should be keeping comes right back to the state.
And we use that for youth hunts and all sorts of things, mm-hmm. don't we?
Yep.
Yeah.
Mostly
so.
Outreach projects and stuff like that.
I just thought that'd be something you'd be interested in knowing.
Mm-hmm. That's good information, Kevin. Thank you. Okay, I think we're ready to entertain a motion. Rusty?
I'll make a motion to accept the plan as read.
Okay.
The division presented.
Do we have a second? Okay, we have a second. That was by Sean. Okay. Do we have any discussion? All those in favor? Okay, that's unanimous. We'll move on to the next action item, which is number 6, and that's the aquatic invasive species rule. And Jordan Nelson's going to present that to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my goal and the goal of the Utah AIS program to keep our water safe from from any kind of species that might come in that would damage our ability to use the water, whether it's for irrigation, water transfer for culinary purposes, recreation, and fishing. While it's really important to do this as a state, AIS problems are kind of a ubiquitous problem across the country. As such, I work on a panel, a national panel, to try to make sure that we accomplish that goal of keeping all of our water safe in the western United States. One of the things that we've been working on is trying to make our programs similar across all of the states in the West, so that a boater that boats in Utah but also goes to Wyoming or Idaho, Nevada, Arizona, all have a similar experience and receive the same message. If a boat is decontaminated here, it counts once you go to another state, so you don't have to go through multiple decontaminations. This is quite the process because all of us have different laws and different rules that dictate what authority we have and how we can actually run our program. So as we're going through this process, we're doing our best to find the low-hanging fruit that we can actually work on and come to a consensus agreement. One of the first steps that we've identified is to be able to classify all of our water bodies the same way. So if we find some form of an invasive mussel in a lake, we're calling it the same thing that Wyoming or Montana is calling it. And so we can communicate back and forth. That rule needs to be changed, or that classification system needs to be changed in rule so that we can match our surrounding states and do a better job of communicating and protecting our waters. Currently, our classification system isn't written into rule, nor is it declassification in the chance that we can take a water body off of the list of places that are affected by invasive species. However, we do have some definitions. Currently, we use detected or suspected as kind of a lower classification. That classification lasts for 3 years when it's stepped down to what we call inconclusive, which isn't governed by rule or law, and stays there for 2 years. So it takes 5 years for a water body to be removed from a detected or suspected classification. And then we also use infested, which is kind of a dirty word everywhere. Nobody wants to have an infested water, which takes 3 years at infested, then it steps down to detected or suspected for another 3 years, and then down to inconclusive for a total of 8 years. Now, as I mentioned, that's not all written into rule, especially the declassification portion. And it's been somewhat of a moving target over the last 5 years, and we want to write that into rule so that it's so that we can follow our rule and make sure that we're treating everywhere the same. So under the new system that we've agreed upon as Western states, we would split up detected and suspected. So we have a suspect water, and I'll go through and explain what each of these means. That if a water body is classified as that, it lasts for 3 years. There's no step down to another level so that the message is more clear what it is exactly that we have there. And then it would be taken off of the list, assuming that we don't find any more invasive species there. Detected similarly, but last 5 years, infested for 7, and then we're going to put all of this into rule so that we can hold ourselves to our own standard. Currently, with the detected or suspected level, I explained that lasts for 5 years with a step down to inconclusive in between taking it completely off the list. As a western region, we've agreed that we will call this suspect, and that classification will last for 3 years. So a suspect water will mean that we go out, we sample the reservoir, we pull a plankton tow, or we find a mussel attached to a dock. We find a single sample, we visually verify that, and then we send it off and we do genetic work to genetically verify it. Particularly when we find the larval form or the baby forms of these mussels, they're very hard to identify, so we make sure to use genetics and we send it to two different labs to ensure that we don't get false positives or false negatives. An example of this is right here in the southern region with Sand Hollow Reservoir. Right now it's classified as infested, but under this new sample that we've identified a mussel in Sand Hollow Reservoir, it would be reclassified as a suspect water. The next step up would be detected, which doesn't really fit into the classification scheme that we're using now. This would mean that we go out and we take two or more consecutive samples where we can identify mussels, we can verify it with DNA. This has a little bit more strength in our sampling, indicating that, yeah, there's possibly a real problem there and not just a fluke of sampling something that might have come off of a boat and may not be established in the water. An example of this would be Lake Powell and what we saw late last year in 2012 when we had multiple samples where we pulled quagga mussel veligers out of the water. The final classification would be infested. Currently, this lasts for 8 years. The western region has agreed that it should last 7. We would classify a water body as infested once we go and we sample multiple times and we find multiple age classes of attached mussels, indicating that mussels are present and they're reproducing. An example of this, again, would be Lake Powell and what we found this spring when we found multiple sizes of attached invasive mussels to boats and docks. Just as a recap, and a further explanation of this declassification system, the time begins on the countdown with these once we have a negative sample. So back to the Lake Powell example. Assuming at some point in the future, right now it's classified as infested, assuming at some point in the future we go out and we sample and we don't find anything, that's when the countdown would start, the 7 years of being classified as infested. As long as we go consistently sample through that 7 years, we would feel comfortable with downgrading that or taking it off of a list. But if at any point during that 7 years we sample again and find a mussel or any other at any life stage, the countdown would start again. So it needs to be sampled negative for 7 years consistently to be taken off of that list. And similarly with the other classifications, 3 years or 5 years. We've also made some concessions in this new rule rewrite for water bodies that might be able to drain and treat immediately. Those would be put under a suspect classification and under the director's orders, and we would consistently sample that over a few years before we would take it off of a classification, any kind of a mussel water body affected list. An example of that might be Grantsville Reservoir by Tooele, small irrigation reservoirs where they can drain it completely, divert the water away from it, treat it with some kind of a chemical before they refill it and ensure that everything is dead. So what does that mean for waters in Utah right now? Well, right now, Lake Powell isn't classified as infested. It would retain that classification under this new rule. Red Fleet Reservoir has been classified as a mussel-affected water body in the past. It's sampled for 5 years straight with no findings of mussels. We would remove it from any kind of a mussel-affected list. It would be a clean reservoir for boaters. Electric Lake is similar to Red Fleet Reservoir. In Sand Hollow, we would declassify that to a suspect water, where under the rule rewrite, it would be under the designation of the director of the Division of Wildlife, where that has already sampled for 3 years without any findings of a physical mussel in the water body. We would be able to take that off of the list as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any questions from the RAC? Any questions from the
result? Brian had a question.
I just have a question because I'm kind of dumb when it comes to these mussels. So when a lake gets them and you test positive once, I mean, you go back and test and they're not there. So what happens to them? I know that they're bad and they're not good. But how did the lake get? They just not taking the lake, or what generally happens there?
Right. There's enough boat traffic in Utah from water bodies that are infested with mussels that I'm fairly confident in saying that every single water body that can receive a boat in Utah has had some kind of contact with mussels, most likely in the larval form, the small veligers. Now, those veligers, their survival rate is extremely low, a fraction of a percent. One female can produce up to 1 million veligers in a year, and the survival rate is extremely small. So if we go and sample at a reservoir and find a veliger, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's an adult there reproducing. It could have come from a boat, ballast water, a fishing live well, and we could have just been lucky and found it. But if we do find that, it makes us hyper aware to anything that might be going on there to make sure that we don't have an infestation.
Gil?
Question, Jordan, just on your declassification. What if you went from, if we take Lake Powell, we've got quagga mussels there. If we went 5 years without finding quaggas, and I don't know how we'd ever get there, I hope we figure out a way. But then you find a zebra mussel on year six. Does it keep the infested, or does it change to another classification?
It would retain the infested classification.
Even if you switch species?
That's a good question. I haven't really thought about switching species. I suppose that we would retain a classification as infested for quagga mussels, specific to a species, and then it would be suspect water for zebra mussels.
Okay. I guess that was more my question. Would the time reset for the quagga mussel infestation?
It wouldn't for the quagga mussels, but I would imagine that if we had zebra mussels, that if we found a zebra mussel, there would be more. And we would be out sampling more to figure that out.
But I don't even know the difference between the two, but I know there's two different kinds.
Yeah, quagga mussels are slightly bigger and a lot more aggressive and can live in deeper water.
Right. Thank you.
Otherwise, they're very closely related and very similar.
Any additional questions? Questions from the public? Comments from the public? Have no cards? Comments from the rack? Okay, we're ready to entertain a motion. Brian? Oh, Mike. Go ahead, Mike.
I'll move that we accept the modifications to rule R657-60, the aquatic invasive species interdiction.
Okay, do we have a second? Another Mike? Okay, we have a motion and a second to approve this rule. Any comments? All those in favor? Unanimous. Okay, we'll move on to our next action item, which is the landowner permits rule, and that will be by Teresa.
All right. So we would like to make a modification to the landowner permit rule, R657-43. The change would allow for the certificate of registration and any of those variants associated with it to be valid for 3 years. So that would make it consistent with how we do our CWMU applications at this point. This would allow for landowners associations to amend a certificate of registration annually to allow for any property changes, any change in ownership. And it would allow the division to adjust permit numbers annually if limited entry permit numbers change. Thank you.
Wow. That's the shortest one on record. Okay, do we have any questions from the right?
We have to do them annually right now.
I have a question on where that picture of that buck was taken.
I do not know. Maybe somewhere near Morgan?
I would venture to guess it was Morgan County because Scott put this together.
Any additional questions? Any comments? Okay, we're ready to entertain a motion. Brian?
Make a motion that we pass the rule amendment R657-43 as presented.
Thank you. Do we have a second to that motion? Okay, Claire, we have a second. So we have a motion and a second to pass this rule. Any comments? Okay, all those in favor? It's unanimous. Great. And we'll move on to our next action item, which is the cougar rule. And John's going to present that to us.
Great, thank you. This one should be relatively quick as well. Some minor changes in our cougar rule, minor modifications, basically. So we've got two parts here. The first is just some basic bookkeeping edits and some terminology and language in the rule that, as we looked at it, we noticed we needed to fix. Mm-hmm. And then another one is the more substantive thing, which is this depredation permit, which is a sort of a tweak on the way we do things already. The first clarification is just a definition. Essentially, immediate, as we're looking through here, we noticed that immediate family member wasn't defined in the rule, and it's important relative to depredation and who can take a cougar. So we just added this language, which puts it into, makes it just like all the other rules that have that definition in it. Also, something with firearms, too. Here is where what the language looks like now, but in order to put this into similar format as the other rules we have, big game, et cetera, we have to add that little bit of language talking about muzzle loaders and muzzle loaders with scopes. So this just gets everything into shape. Same thing on firearms relative to pursuit. The language now, so the person, if you're just pursuing, you can't carry with you, but that's not fitting the way we're doing our Second Amendment things these days, so we'll strike this language so someone, if they're legally allowed to carry a firearm, they can legally, we can't permit or prevent them from doing that. So we'll clean that up in the rule. Now, the bigger thing are these livestock owner permits, and I'll talk a little bit about a background and how they came to be and sort of how they work, and then a summary of what kind of impact we expect from them. Essentially, right now, a livestock owner can already remove a cougar if it's within that 72 hours of that depredation. But that's a little difficult in the sense that those depredations are often during the summer or spring, and there's no snow on the ground, and the cougars are harder to track, harder to find, and harder to take out. So, and then also, they have to juggle with wildlife services sometimes. They've got a guy available. They're spread more thin these days than they had been in the past, and they haven't always been able to get in and help out as quickly as they could. So that's sort of the first place to go to, but sometimes wildlife services can't always be there. So there's a desire to be able to have some winter removals to be able to pull cougars out during the time of year when it's easier to find them and do it proactively. So if there's an area where sheep are killed often, to do some removals before the sheep get on. So rather than wait for kills, keep kills from happening is the idea. It also is good because it allows landowners to help themselves. So if they've got a problem, it's kind of nice to empower people to be able to take care of the problem themselves rather than make it, you know, more amplified. And finally, a lot of this came out, the idea for this came out of discussions at our public meetings at that last RAC board when I took the cougar out. So the permit itself basically just says the division may issue depredation permits to take cougar on specified private lands and public land grazing allotments that have a documented history of ongoing cougar depredation on livestock. It says that we may issue one or more permits to the owner or designee, but one of the important aspects of it is the owner cannot receive any monetary compensation for the use of that permit. The division would also set what the legal weapons are to use and specify the exact area of where a cougar may be taken from, which would usually be that private land or that allotment. It'd be the delineation of those boundaries. Any cougar taken to this, according to this, would have to be surrendered to the division. There's no allowing of them to get a permit and then keep that cougar themselves. The idea is this is purely to remove the animals for depredation purposes, and there shouldn't be any other incentive other than that. So what this means in summary is that these new permits would be available for people to take cougars out on specified lands. They would have to have a documented history of depredation, and by documented history, we expect wildlife services have gone in and confirmed several cougar kills on the livestock. We would allow, we'd determine what the allowable weapons are. We'd write that in the permit. We'd say what the season is, what the months that people, that this permit is valid, and exactly where they could use it. The livestock owner couldn't receive any monetary compensation or sell it, and the cougars would remain the property of the state. And what we expect from this, if it goes through, is that producers may take cougars the following winter. So if they have depredations one summer, we could write a permit that they could take cougar the next winter and spring before the livestock hit the allotment. And that would allow them to proactively affect their, or to protect their livestock. The flip side of it, I guess, if there's a there's an impact on cougars, is that right now the rule is more focusing on the 72 hours and trying to get an offending animal, whereas this one's less likely, may or may not get a potentially offending animals. It's more of treating an area versus trying to go after a specific individual cougar. So there's that sort of difference in how it's applied biologically. But that's sort of the overall view of this thing. And with that, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any questions from the rack?
So if you have an allotment and they're chasing a cougar in pursuit and it goes off the allotment, can they continue to pursue it?
We've discussed that quite a bit. I think we've settled on, yes, they have to be on the allotment. It ought to be clear that they've started that process on the land. As we know, these things could go a ways. So they would still be able to take it, but there'd be some reasonable distance, and really they'd have to prove that they started on the land that they were in for.
Yeah, John, what does that, I think you defined this, but the definition of ongoing depredation, is that within the year or within 2 years or?
That's something that is in this rule, it isn't addressed. The way the rule is actually written, it says chronic or numerous. And we're leaving that either for input from the RACs and board to define it more narrowly. But right now we're leaving that, we're not trying to paint ourselves into a corner, because some of the discussions kind of come up is, how many is numerous, is how many is chronic, and if you've only got 20 sheep out there and you kill two are killed, then that's huge impact versus killing two on a bigger operation. It's still an impact, but it's less. So in that, most all these operations and all the producers, all the situations are different. We left it this way to give us a little more discretionary authority to help people out if it looks like this will help them out.
Now you mentioned that you left it so that maybe for discussion with the RAC. Is that what you want, is discussion with the RAC on this to develop the definition for an ongoing problem, or?
I guess I look at this process, this is the public process,
right.
And this is the time to have input onto that. So this question has come up. A lot of these, this sort of the unclear things have come up in the RACs that I've done so far, and they've discussed it and have more or less gone with what we've, with little tweaks with what we've presented, but it's promoted some pretty good discussion in some of them. So I encourage you, if you want to hash it out, please do, but if you're comfortable with the way it's done, that's saying something as well.
Okay, Sean.
Any cats killed on these tags, are they going to be counted against the harvest objective for that unit?
The way we're going at it right now, they would be, if it's done on, say, a split unit, they'd be, or a limited entry, they'd be counted towards the permits there. And that's something the northern region, yes, the northern region attached that as an amendment, asking that we count these toward the quota. They will be counted.
We need it on tape.
We need it recorded.
Brian, can you repeat that in the microphone?
Okay, I'll do this for real this time. Do you have any estimate of how many of these permits may be issued in a year, southern region? A rough guess?
I'm thinking very few. My guess is, statewide, 5-10. Maybe somebody, by this door opening, it might change things, but I don't think it would, I don't think this would be a huge impact biologically.
Brian, could you repeat your question?
My question was just clarifying that they do count on the quota in the unit.
To clarify again, it's that detail is not in the rule, but we expect to any cougars taken out with these permits would be counted against the quota for that area or unit.
Okay, Mike?
My question is, who determines if this is a depredation problem? Does the livestock owner, does the landowner, or does the division, the state, who makes that determination?
We would rely heavily on Wildlife Services to be, that'd be our third party that says, yes, this was cougar depredation, and these were three cougar depredations, and then start from there.
Kaylin?
Yeah, John, just noticing the language that I hadn't noticed before, you said that the division will specify the method of take. Does that open it up to private trapping in some instances?
We would write, certainly, I'm trying to think if we get conflicting with trapping for cougars. I forget how it's written in the cougar rule.
Probably just something to clarify with Marty, maybe.
Because we can already
go forward.
We might be able to, which would be neat. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly. I think we'd be able to allow it, but I'm not exactly sure. I'd have to double check.
Okay, I have a quick question just for the RAC. Did everybody receive a letter from the Utah Houndsman in your emails? Okay. Instead of reading this letter into the minutes, I'd leave this up to you guys at your discretion if you want to incorporate any comments here in ways of a question or a comment, or we don't have to address it at all. Mike, do you have a question?
I just had one other question regarding what Kevin brought up about trapping. If you do trap, I would imagine you're going to write in the size of trap that the trappers need to use or the size of snare.
I think that's excellent advice.
Before they let them loose.
Right. I think it's excellent. I think there's a lot of this is in the level of detail and getting a precise, good boundary for what the boundary is and what weapons or what devices we'd use. That's excellent.
Okay, any additional questions? Have any questions from the public? Do we have any comments from the RAC? Okay, I guess we're ready to entertain a motion. Okay, Claire?
I move that we accept as presented the Cougar Rule Amendment R657-10.
Okay, do we have a second? We have a second from Brian. Do we have any discussion on this motion? Okay, all those in favor? It's unanimous. Okay, the last item on the agenda is other business, and the other business includes looking at the agenda or the schedule of RAC meetings for next year, and so everybody should have it in front of you, and so we would have the ability to discuss the dates and also the locations of these meetings.
Dates are a little more difficult to change, and so unless there's a huge conflict, let's try to stick to locations, because there's a lot that, you know, it adjusts lots of other things in other parts of the state if we start messing with dates.
That's not fun. What's that?
That's not fun,
though.
Okay, Mike.
What about the items on the agenda? You know, some of our meetings are really loaded. Other meetings like this one aren't. Can't we move some of the items to a different time?
I'll let Kevin address that. I think they try to do that but certain things come in a certain order. So
yeah, the order of the RAC meetings really has to do with it's really tied to the application period and the draw process, and when we get data. So like the big game, the permit recommendations have to be in April because we've got to have those numbers to the contractor, but we can't have them earlier than that because of the data on all of our classifications and our population estimates and all that stuff that goes into us determining how many permits we don't have before that. And so it's pretty, we do recognize as a division, and we have for years, that that there are some meetings that are very long. But I remind you that, and some of you may not be aware, we used to have the antlerless permit numbers set separately from the bucks and bulls, and they're pretty intimately tied, and people wanted to understand how the two went together. And so it was about 2 or 3 years ago we combined those, and that made for a really long meeting, but it also canceled a meeting, which is why we now have January, February, and March without any RAC meetings. So there's certainly a trade-off there, but we do recognize that with, you know, condensing and having fewer RAC meetings, you know, it's fewer meetings, but they certainly can be lengthy meetings.
Well, I remember when we did the fishing guide recommendation, it seemed like there wasn't, correct me if I'm wrong, it seemed like there wasn't a lot of comments, or it wasn't a very long meeting, but we drove clear to Richfield to go through that. Maybe that's, but again, I'm from St. George, and so maybe, I don't know, there's some comments there that we, you know, we might think about. The other thing is there's, you know, some critical meetings, the big game permit numbers, and some of these that are highly attended. Does it make sense? It seemed like last year we did that one in Richfield. You know, I just throw these things out for you guys to think about and comment if we want to make any suggestions, or especially on the location. Sounds like that's our biggest ability to comment on.
I would point out also that the April RAC that's currently scheduled to be in Beaver has also been scheduled at 5 o'clock instead of 7 o'clock. So just, you know, be aware of that. And then I think the November meeting is a different time at 6 o'clock, because those are the two meetings that tend to be longer than the others.
You need a motion?
If you want to change anything, you probably ought to do it in the form of a motion, but if you like it the way it is, or, you know, there probably ought to be a motion to just accept it as laid out. Either way, that way it's covered.
I'll make a motion to accept the annual agenda for the Southern Region RAC meetings as presented.
Okay, we have a motion. Do we have a second? Sean has a second. Do we have any discussion on the motion? Okay, all those in favor? It's unanimous. That was easy. Okay, we'll adjourn.